So we're going to pick up where we left off last week and then head to a series of thoughts that are not only appropriate to the topic of last week and this week, but also to the Seder night. Last week we mentioned that this is the turning point in the year, that there are two Rosh Hashanah, there are two major new years on the Jewish calendar, the new year of Tishrei and the new year of Nisan. And we are now transitioning from Adar Sheni to Nisan, so therefore we are at a point where we're beginning the year again on the level of Chadashim, on the level of months. And we noted that there are four Parshiot. We're going to see a fifth today, actually. There are four special Parshiot that mark the end of the year and the beginning of the next. Those two, if you remember, the first two that we dealt with were Parshas Shkalim and Parshas Zachor. We're going to turn very briefly to the next, which is Parshas Parah. Parshas Parah is really the hardest one to understand. Parshas Parah is read each year on the Shabbos after Shabbos Zachor, and it is a parsha in which we read the section which we dealt with a few weeks ago from Parshas Chukas, dealing with the concept of Tumah and Tahara, dealing with the concept of, for want of a better term, there's no proper English translation, of purity and impurity. And Parshas Parah speaks to us of the creation of the ashes of the red heifer, of the Parah Adumah, which will affect the purification of someone who has been defiled through Tumas Mace, who has come into contact with death. And this is considered one of the major chukot, one of the major chukim in the Torah, one of the major laws that are beyond our understanding in the Torah text. And the question is, why do we read that parsha specifically at this time of the year? Why has it become one of the four parshiot? So if you take a look at the second paragraph on your first page, taken from the Mishnah Berurah, the Mishnah Berurah really gives us two reasons. Number one, he says it was at this time that people were preparing to come to Yerushalayim for the Pesach sacrifice, and were going through a process of ritual purification in order to do so. So this is a remnant of that past. It's a reminder of those preparations. And he says it's also an implicit prayer that we will return to the day when these rituals will once again become part of our lives. Now, just to comment on that, I happen to be writing a volume, which I hope eventually I'll finish and publish, concerning the cycle of the year. I'm at the point where I'm talking about the 3 weeks and Tisha B'Av and mourning the loss of the temple. And I wrote a section dealing with how to make that relevant to our lives. It was probably one of the hardest sections that I have in the text that I'm dealing with. Because how do we take these concepts? How do we take the concept of Parah Adumah? How do we take the concept of Tumah and Tahara, Aliyah LeYerushalayim, Beis HaMikdash, the Karbanot, and make them relevant to our lives? And there are a variety of ways to approach it. But I think what we have to recognize is that what we are facing is a world which is vastly different from our own. It's one that we can hardly really understand. It's so different from our current lives. And yet it is a time, at its best, which is a time when God's presence is palpably felt within the community through various different things and the existence of a Beis HaMikdash, and a time when our bonds with each other, the way in which we dealt with each other, was much stronger and clearer as well, because we had centralized worship and there was a sense of unity within the people. Like all rituals, it's only as good as we allow it to be. And unfortunately, we didn't allow the Mikdash to make the changes in us that it needed to make, and we lost the Mikdash because of that. But a recognition and an implicit prayer that we should be able to contemplate that world, and even though it's different from our own, recognize that maybe there's a lack in our world when we don't have those kinds of bonds that existed then. So that's Parshas Parah. Fascinating fact is that there are some halachic decisors who consider the reading of Parshas Parah to be a deoraisa, just like the reading of Parshas Zachor. There are those who consider it to be a biblical mitzvah, just as is the reading of Parshat Zachor. Not everybody, it's a debate, but that they should even suggest it shows us the importance of Parshas Paro. Now let's go to what's more relevant for us as we approach the holiday of Pesach, and that is the section of Parshas HaChodesh, which we read this past week on Shabbos, and its introduction to the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. If you take a look at Parshas HaChodesh, I just have the beginning of the section that we read for you at the bottom of page one. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. Oh, actually, before we get into Parshas HaChodesh, I have to make two announcements which I forgot to make. Number one, I'd like to, on all of our behalf, thank the anonymous sponsors of our shiur throughout the year. And secondly, this particular shiur, and I apologize for not saying this earlier, this particular shiur is sponsored by the Friedman family, Le'ilui Nishmas Yosef Avraham ben Isaiah Zatzal, or Yeshaya Zatzal. Once again, we thank the Friedman family for sponsoring this shiur, and again, our anonymous sponsors for the year. Let's go back now to Shabbos HaChodesh. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aaron be'eretz Mitzrayim lemor. HaChodesh hazeh lochem rosh chodeshim rishon hu lochem lechodshei hashana. Let's start with that. Picture the scene. Let's see where we are. We are now still in Egypt, at the point where HaKadosh Baruch Hu has announced that Yetzias Mitzrayim is imminent. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. He's announced that the last plague is going to rain down on the Egyptians, and Paro is going to chase us out of Mitzrayim. The Torah says, Hashem speaks to Moshe and Aaron, Be'eretz Mitzrayim, while we're still in Egypt. And he says, HaChodesh hazeh lochem rosh chodeshim rishon hu lochem lechodshei hashana. This month is for you, the month of Nisan, the first of the months of the year. And there are two, according to Chazal, within that sentence, there are two different commandments or two different components. One is the concept of HaChodesh hazeh lochem rosh chodeshim, that you are the ones to sanctify the new year. I'm now giving you the opportunity to be Mekadesh Chodesh. And secondly, that Nisan is, as we've said, the first of the months of the year. It's the Rosh Hashanah for the months of the year. Now we have to stop here, because this is a very, very critical moment in the text. This is the first mitzvah that is given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the national Jewish enterprise, to the Jews. And I won't call them the Jews because we really aren't the Jews yet. It's to the Israelite nation. We are at this point B'nai Yisrael. We're still Israelites. The term Jew comes much later, and again, it's a remnant of our being from the kingdom of Judah, the survivors of the kingdom of Judea. Rashi, the very first Rashi in the Torah, and many of you know this, it's a famous Rashi, says, why doesn't the Torah start here? This is really where, if the Torah is a book of mitzvot, and that's its primary purpose, why not start with the very first mitzvah commanded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Klal Yisrael as a nation? And even though there are mitzvot that emerge in the Torah before this, we have the concept of Bris Milah as a concept, we have the Gid HaNoshe is we're told that you're not allowed to eat the sciatic nerve because of the wrestling with Yaakov. The Rambam and others will say none of those earlier historical allusions create the mitzvah. The mitzvah is only created at this point, the national Jewish birth, and primarily when it's commanded at Har Sinai. That's when mitzvot become incumbent upon us as a people. So Rashi asks a very important question. He says, why did the Torah start with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Why doesn't it start with this moment of history? And Rashi's answer, by the way, is to prove that Eretz Yisrael belongs to us. That's Rashi's answer. Rashi's answer is that Torah begins with creation, to say God creates the world, he gives the lands to who he wants to give it to, and their Eretz Yisrael belongs to us. So if anybody gives us a hard time, nah, never, right? If anyone gives us a hard time, then we have very clear evidence that the Torah that the land belongs to us? One could give a whole series of other answers. There are lots of things that we learn from the patriarchal and matriarchal era that are critical to us as a nation. But nonetheless, having said that, the fact that Rashi and others point, and Rashi's quoting the Medrash, that others suggest that this should be the beginning of the Torah, indicates that this is a very important moment, which raises, of course, a very serious question. If you or I were going to begin the commandments to Klal Yisrael at any particular time, if you or I were going to begin sharing those commandments, with what commandment would you begin? What would be the first mitzvah that you would give to Klal Yisrael? I think if we had a blank slate, we would have chosen something else. We would have chosen V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. We would have chosen Shabbos, maybe. Why does the Torah begin? Why does God begin the commandments to Klal Yisrael with Kiddush HaChodesh? And there's a point in the Haggadah, by the way, which is very important, which underscores this moment as well. You'll remember that the Haggadah asks, why are we doing this tonight? Yachol me rosh chodesh. It's possible that we should have started telling the story when? Not on the night of Pesach, but we should have started with the beginning of the chodesh, with the beginning of the month. And some of the commentaries ask, what would be the Hava Amina? Why would I think I should start telling the story from the beginning of the month? And the answer, because of this first mitzvah. Because this is really the beginning of freedom for the Jewish people. This is where we are becoming a people. So it's important for us to explore, what are the lessons that emerge from this particular mitzvah that make it the right one to begin with, that make it so critical, that are such critical lessons, that this is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to start the litany of commandments to Klal Yisrael. So if you turn the page, and I apparently on your pages, I think page 2 and 3 are mixed up, we come to section B, lessons from Kiddush HaChodesh and the first national, as the first national mitzvah. And each one of these bullets, we could talk about an entire shiur, but we're going to list some of the lessons and just briefly explore some of the lessons that emerge from the concept of Kiddush HaChodesh. Number one, it is a mitzvah that teaches us to mark Jewish time. Our time is different from everybody else's time. Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal speaks of the weaving into the sunset and the sunrise and the days and into the practical physical world, the weaving of spiritual components into the world. He has a beautiful section where he talks about the sunset on Yom Kippur. And when the sun sets on Yom Kippur, he says his father took him out from the shul and said to him, this sunset is different from every other sunset of the year, because this sunset is the sunset that marks the receiving of forgiveness from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And very beautifully, you can picture for a moment, and Rav Soloveitchik was a very, very rigid halachist. You can see the poetry as well within the halacha. The poetry that says we're not looking for esoteric experiences, we're looking to weave into that which exists the experiences of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, Jewish time is extremely important. How we mark our time every day. When is Sof Zman Kriya Shma? When we're going to say Mincha? When are we going to say Maariv? Time and how we invest it with Kedusha is extremely important. One of the ways we know how important it is from our enemies. Antiochus, among the things that he prohibited was the concept of Kiddush HaKodesh. He prohibited the marking of Jewish time. He says, you can't mark Jewish time anymore. And one realizes that if you take away that marking of Jewish time, you will destroy Judaism. Next, partnership. And this is one of the most important aspects of Kiddush HaKodesh. And to appreciate its power, you have to recognize that it is being given, as the Torah says, Be'eretz Mitzrayim. It's being given to the Israelites while they're still enslaved, while we're just beginning to move towards freedom. And imagine HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to them and says, I want you to understand, I am making you my partner. I am raising you. You are not who you think you are. You're not lowly slaves. I am making you a partner with me in the sanctification of the world. And nowhere is that concept of partnership more clearly seen than in the midst of Kiddush HaChodesh. Let's understand, God creates the cycle of the moon, but it is Beis Din that determines when the Chodesh begins. There's an option in that cycle of going to 29 days for the month, or an additional day to 30. It can either be a month that is chaser or male. It can either be 29 days long, or it can be a 30-day month. Dependent on how you decide, that may seem like not really that important, but it's very important. Because if that month is a 29-day month, then Yom Kippur is going to be on a specific day. If that month is a 30-day month, if we're talking about the month before Tishrei, right, then Yom Kippur is going to be on a different day. And dependent on how you decide, when you determine that month ends, will determine all the chagim that will flow in the next month. Along comes HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, I want you to understand, Chodesh Hazeh Lochem. This month is given to you, say the rabbi, says Rashi right on the spot, quoting the Chazal, Misura Lochem. It's given over to you. And if Beis Din does not sanctify the month, if you make a mistake, Kodesh Baruch Hu will accept it. That's the point. That's how halacha works. It's so important for us to understand that. That halacha is given over to man to use as well as he can and for the experts to apply. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying is, whatever you decide, as long as you are loyal to the process and following the law, then I will accept that decision. The Medrash paints this beautiful picture. The Medrash says that Rosh Hashanah of Tishrei is approaching, and everybody is starting to get ready. They want to get ready in the heavenly court. So they say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when is Rosh Hashanah? Tell us when it's going to start so we can put up the bima, so we can get ready. He says, what are you asking me for? He says, go down and ask the Beis Din downstairs. They go down and ask the Beis Din. Beis Din says, oh, we're going to make it a 29-day month. They start putting up the bima. Then all of a sudden the Beis Din says, oh, no, we decided it's a 30-day month. They take everything down. Again, this is figurative. What's the Medrash saying? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, I'm not going to decide that. I'm handing it over to you. And this, again, it's the secret of the brilliance of halacha. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're really the only faith tradition that has this concept, where God takes the law, divine law, and hands it over to fallible man. And says, in this area, as long as it's not a halacha l'moshe m'sinai, as long as it's not written law, as long as it's you're using the methods of application, and as long as it's the experts that are doing it, again, it's the people that are doing it, that know how to do it, once that decision is made, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to accept it. And this truth is underscored by Chazal over and again in the Gemara. And the most famous example of this is the famous story, which I've told you before, and some of you may have heard it from others than me. It's the famous story of the Tanur Shel Achnai. What's the Tanur Shel Achnai? The Tanur Shel Achnai is, there was a question in rabbinic thought in the Gemara whether a certain oven could be koshered. Very important as we're approaching Pesach. But this was made out of a pottery oven. This was made out of, and it, pottery can't be koshered. But it was then broken and then put back together. So maybe now it could be koshered. And the rabbis are debating it in the Beis Medrash. And the rabbis come to a decision that the oven cannot be koshered. And along, Rabbi Eliezer, who is a very, very strong halachist, stands up and says, I know I'm right, you're wrong. You can kosher this oven. And he turns to the heavens, and according to the Gemara, and again, you need not take this literally. It's the figurative message. It's the message that's most important. He turns to the heavens, and he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I know I'm right, and if I'm right, you see that tree outside the Beis Medrash? I want that tree to move. I want it to jump. And the tree begins to jump. And he says, I know I'm right. And if I'm right, you see the stream that's flowing outside the Beis Medrash? I want that stream to flow backwards. I want it to flow upriver instead of downriver. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes a miracle and it flows the other way. And then he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if I'm right, I want the walls of the Beis Medrash to move in. And the walls begin to move in. And he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, tell them I'm right. And there's a bas kol that comes from the heavens. And the bas kol says, what are you giving Rabbi Eliezer a hard time? Don't you realize that whatever he says in this kind of situation is absolutely correct? And then along comes Rabbi Yehoshua. And Rabbi Yehoshua stands up on his feet and says, Rabbi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this isn't fair. Lo bashamayim hi. The law is not in the heavens anymore. You've given it to us. We've followed the rules. We've applied it according to the way you said to apply it. We've come to a decision. The decision has to remain what we've decided. And the law is decided against Rebbe Eliezer in spite of all the miracles that he performs and in spite of HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying, that's the way I want the law. And the position that the rabbis create is that once God hands the law over to the Chachamim to apply, then he gives them a right to come to a decision, and whatever decision, as long as they're loyal to the process, he'll accept. The Gemara goes on by continuing and saying that one of the Rebbeim meets Eliyahu HaNavi after this event. And he says, he asks Eliyahu, what was HaKadosh Baruch saying after we made that decision against Rebbe Eliezer? And Eliyahu says, you know what he said? Nitzchuni banai nitzchuni. He said, my children have defeated me. That's the way it usually is translated. But Rav Soloveitchik or the Vilna Gaon, I'm not sure who said this, says, no, there's another way to understand that statement. It could be nitzchuni, not banai nitzchuni, coming from the word nitzachon, but alternatively it could mean nitzchuni coming from the word netzach. What does netzach mean? My children, eternal. My children have made me eternal. Because by understanding that this is the legal process, they understand that will allow the law to be what? Applied in every generation. And the fact that you will be able to apply, you won't be sitting in a corner waiting for me to tell you what to do, but you're going to be hitting the books and applying the law, that will make this law eternal. And Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, the preeminent halachic decisor of the 20th century, in his introduction to Igros Moshe, which is his halachic work, which is a series of responsa, it's like letters that were written to him and his answers. In the introduction, he says, I don't want to do this. This is very hard. This is the responsibility of being a posek is extremely, extremely troubling. Maybe I'll make a mistake. But he says, I know to do it. I know I have the ability to do this. You know why? Because God says that if I do my job, he'll accept whatever I come up with. He will accept the answer to which I arrive. And that becomes the brilliance of halacha, that when it comes to the application of law, there are different sections of oral law, but when it comes to the application of law to particular events around us, and the rabbi's application of that law follows the rules that it's supposed to follow, Kadosh Baruch Hu will agree with the decisions that we come to. Now, as an aside, this worked better, of course, when we had a Sanhedrin, and we could come up with unified halachot. It's more difficult when we are disparate, but the answer is you find your posek, you find your rabbi, you find the person who's your halachic decisor, and those are the decisions that you follow. Next, and this is all part of this mitzvah of Kiddush HaKodesh. So the mitzvah of Kiddush HaKodesh establishes in such a clear way this concept of partnership between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and man. It's saying, I may create the cycle of the moon, but you determine its significance. You are my partner. It is also giving us the concept of controlling time. Now let's, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal has a very, very beautiful essay, and it's actually, he speaks about this in a number of locations, where he talks about time awareness that is uniquely Jewish and that allows us to control time. Because truth is, of all the elements of our lives, time would seem to be the one which is most outside of our control. Right? Time goes, no matter what you do about it. This instant exists for a split second, and then it's gone. And when you want it to go slow, it seems to defy us. When you want time to go slow, it goes fast. When you want time to go fast, it goes slow. And yet along comes the rub and says, well, but you know, you can control time by taking yourself out of time and following three time awareness procedures. And he calls them retrospection, anticipation, and appreciation. Retrospection, he says, is living the past. In other words, recognizing that the past is not just a memory, but it is an essential component in your present. It's part of your life. He says the Jews retrospect in ways that other people in the world don't. We carry the past with us. We carry it on our shoulders. When we sit down at the Seder, we think of all the Jews throughout history that have sat down at their Sidorim. We sense this concept of retrospection. When we stand at the Kotel, we think of all those who tried to get there and never had the opportunity. We're those of us who, in our world, were either in the Shoah or had relatives in the Shoah or parents or grandparents, we carry the memories of those people with us. When we enter Eretz Yisrael, the land is divided not just to the Jews that enter, but there's a whole computation that factors in the generation before. You're carrying your parents in with you as well. So there's this concept of retrospection that's very powerful in Jewish thought. Then there's a concept of anticipation. Anticipation means we're traveling somewhere. Here the Rav makes a very interesting observation. He says, what is the Jewish contribution to historical awareness? It's the concept of a destiny-driven history. A destiny-driven history means I'm not just propelled by the past, but I'm pulled by the future. I'm going somewhere. This is all going somewhere. What it will be like, I can't fully describe, but it's something called Yemos HaMashiach. And the fact that we live that life, the fact that we believe that history isn't just a haphazard series of events that are caused one after another by what came before, but that it is a history that's being pulled by the future, that we're going somewhere, that's anticipation. It's anticipation. And finally, the most important element of time awareness is appreciation. It's appreciation of the moment in which you live. And you can only appreciate the moment in which you live if you retrospect and anticipate and let that color the way you see your world. So therefore, what is it? And this is the hardest of all. To appreciate the moment in which you live is the hardest of all three. Because who knows what does this moment mean? What are the historical components? What's going to make a difference? What's going to happen? Who am I? Where do I fit in? A war in Ukraine, what's that going to cause? Is it going to cause a World War III, God forbid? Is it not? How are the dominoes going to flow? What's my role? What's my role? I know my wife has been busy for the last week and a half. Every day she's working with a group of volunteers supplying supplies to the Ukrainian refugees. And she's meeting these people, and she's meeting these people daily. And she says, you look at their eyes and you see what they've lost. You see what's happened to these people. These are real people. These aren't numbers. And they are, most of them are very educated and very well read, and their whole lives have been uprooted, and they don't know where they're going to start and where they're going to go. And the fact that they have an Israel to come to, the fact that they have a place to come to now, and that will accept them and will bring them in and will make them citizens because of their background. This is all an amazing, amazing thing. And what does it mean to live at that time? What does it mean? And the fact that we fail to appreciate is when we really lose. When we fail to appreciate the times in which we live is when we lose the Beis HaMikdash, when we lose the land, because we're not taking advantage of the opportunities given to us. So appreciation is extremely important. Says the Rav, when you accomplish all three, if every moment has past, present, and future in it, then you control time. Then no longer is time controlling you, but you are recognizing you've created an awareness of time that is above time, that's eternal. Because past, present, and future merge into one. Take a look at the Seder night. Take a look at how the Seder is constructed, right? Take a look at it on a global fashion. It's before the meal, and after the meal, right? Now, one could argue that that's the way Jews view time, before the meal, and after the meal. But why do we construct the Seder that way? Wouldn't it make more sense to put the whole Haggadah before the meal, to do everything before the meal, and then eat afterwards? Or to do everything after the meal, which nobody would ever do. But why put the meal smack dab in the center? And the answer is, if you look at the way the Haggadah is constructed, it follows these three time periods. Everything before the meal speaks of the past. Everything before, in fact, the meal is in the middle of Hallel. It's in the middle of Hallel. We break Hallel into two. That part of Hallel that comes before speaks of Betzeis Yisrael Mimitzrayim. It's all speaking of the past. Everything after the meal is the future. Eliyahu Hanavi, all of the dreams, Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim, the Hallel speaks of a future redemption. And therefore, what's the meal? The meal is the present. Smack dab, a meal plunked into the flow of history. And what should that meal be filled with? Not just food, but discussion. Who are we? Where do we fit in? How can we make our opportunities come to fruition and realize our challenges? All of that, that's the meal. Think of that meal as an event within the flow of history. So therefore, imagine, and the Rav goes even further. What is it that distinguishes a slave from a free man, he says? What distinguishes a slave from a free man is the control of time. A slave is not in control of his time. Everything he has to do is at the will of someone else. And imagine HaKadosh Baruch Hu turning to those slaves and saying to them, what? You're not slaves anymore. Look up to the sky. Look at the moon. You can control your time. Next, following the moon. Why is it that we follow a lunar calendar? Why don't we follow a solar calendar? Again, Torah doesn't tell us, but there are lessons that the rabbis do derive. Now, it should be said, by the way, that we're not a pure lunar calendar. We are a lunar solar calendar, in that we follow the moon primarily, but there are aspects of our calendar that do correlate to solar events. The fact that we made a leap year this year was to ensure that Pesach would come out in the spring and wouldn't get slowly moved year by year by year to end up somewhere in the middle of the fall. And the idea being And other events have to correlate to the solar cycle, to the cycle of agriculture, to the cycle of harvests. So we do have a solar dimension to the calendar. But why is it that it's primarily lunar? So there are all sorts of potential messages that emerge from that. One is that the moon is reflected light, and that our greatness is a reflection of the Torah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That it's not, that we're not the ones creating the light. The most obvious is comes from the word Chodesh. What does the word Chodesh mean? What does it come from? Give me the word. Chadash. Right. There is a sense of renewal in the moon's cycle. It's not static. It's growing. We're always recognizing that. That's why you have, for many people, a Yom Kippur Katan, often before Rosh Chodesh, before particular Rosh Chodesh, because it's the time for renewal. It's a time for tshuva. It's a time for change. Why do we follow, however, following the moon and following that lesson, when do we celebrate Rosh Chodesh? Not when the moon is at its fullest. And again, you know, these things are so familiar to us that we don't stop to ask why. Wouldn't it make more sense if you're going to follow the moon and you're going to celebrate a point in its cycle to celebrate what? The full moon. Let's have a harvest moon celebration. Why are we celebrating at the point where the moon is just a little sliver in the heavens? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying to us, the journey is as important as the destination. And sometimes even more important. It's the journey. It's getting there. It's when the moon is only a sliver in the heavens and you have the faith and you believe it's going to become full. Some of the commentaries say that the reason we say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh is to celebrate the miracle of Jewish survival, which mimics the moon. That there are times when you look up at the heavens and you look and you see there's only a sliver and you wonder whether we're going to make it. And then somehow, amen, again, to look at our time and to realize the birth of the state of Israel so soon after the Shoah. Just an amazing... To recognize now who we are, such a central country in global politics, in global doing. Who could have imagined that a Jewish country would be where we are today? Some of it's good, some of it's not so good. I mean, it's amazing how the whole world is so concerned about how Israel is dealing with the Ukrainian refugees. And nobody's worried about how Saudi Arabia is dealing with. Nobody's worried about how... Everybody's worried about Israel. How is Israel dealing with it? Where somehow we are the conscience of the world, and there's a tremendous responsibility that is carried with that. Some of it good, and some of it difficult. But anyway, so therefore, by celebrating the moon at the beginning of the cycle, what are we saying? We're celebrating the journey, life's journey. There's much within the Jewish calendar that teaches us this, that it's not just the destinations in life. It's not just the goals in life. It's the days that take you there. And it's investing each day with significance and meaning. Sometimes we're so focused on getting there that we don't appreciate the passing days. Having said all that, now let's go to the next part of the section of Kiddush HaChodesh. The first part spoke to of Shabbos HaChodesh. The first part spoke to us of the month of Nisan being the month that with which the year starts, and Kiddush HaChodesh. But then God continues, and look at what he says. Turn to the second, to the bottom of page 2. Dabru el kol adas Yisroel lemor. Be'asor lachodesh hazeh, V'yekhu ish lohem sel leves ovo sel abayas. Speak to the people of Israel. And on the 10th of this month, let everyone take a seh, everyone take, and it's either a sheep or a goat, you had the option, to a celebrate ovo sel abayas, a seh for the home to the fathers. V'im yimad habayas miyos miseh, and if one group can't manage to eat this seh, right, and everybody should take the seh. And what this is commanding is that when the Korban Pesach was brought, it required the creation of a chabura. It required the creation of a group. And that group was going to be tasked with what? Consuming the Korban Pesach. Let's remember, the Korban Pesach is not on the altar. The Korban Pesach is consumed as a family meal. And this, in a sense, sets the stage for the Seder night. And that's something important for us to think about for a moment. I often ask when I'm teaching about the Seder, I say, the Seder has us relive what? And the answer I usually get is, it has us relive Yetziat Mitzrayim. And that's not correct. Because on a historical level, we're not reliving the Exodus from Egypt. If we would relive the Exodus from Egypt, when would we perform the Seder? Midday the next day. That's when we left, right? And I would somehow get up and walk around and relive that Exodus. I don't. On a historical level, the scene that I'm recreating is the night before the Exodus. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying to me, okay, go into your homes, retreat to your homes, and experience and share the Korban Pesach. And that raises a very real question. If I had a choice which of those two moments to recreate, I would have probably chosen Yetziat Mitzrayim. I would have said, which is the more important event? The important event is when I left. But that's not so. Why am I recreating the night before? And the lessons are manifold. Let's start with the first. It's at the bottom of the page. The answer lies in the difference between dror and cherus. Two words for freedom. Dror literally means what we translate as liberty. Cherus means true freedom. Dror is controlled by someone else. Someone grants me liberty. It's the removal of external constraints on my ability to act freely. Cherus is spiritual freedom. Cherus is when I'm a free person. And no one can take that or grant that to me. That's something I have to arrive at my own. So the question becomes, when do the Jews really become free? When do the Israelites become free? Well, they achieve dror, they get liberty the next day, midday. But when do they really become free? When in the full view of the Egyptians, they sacrifice their God and they proclaim their religious freedom. And that night, when they are sitting and having that family meal, surrounded by the encroaching darkness of slavery, and they are saying, doesn't matter, we're not slaves anymore, we're a free people, that's when they become free. That's when they achieve Chirut. And if you think about it, that night has had to be replayed over and over again in Jewish history. You can be free and not at liberty, and you can be at liberty and not be free. You can be free and not at liberty. When I visited years ago on the eve of Glasnost, the refuseniks in the Soviet Union, and I remember sitting with them, and I remember saying, I was with a group, and I remember saying to them, how do you do this? I remember them saying to us, which others have said, they said, we're the only free people here in the Soviet Union. What do you mean you're the only free people? You're kicked out of your jobs, you're being persecuted. No, but we're free because they're not controlling us. We're not letting them control us. I remember Anatoly Sharansky, Natan Sharansky, when he walked across that bridge to freedom. I don't know how many of you remember this. When he walked across the bridge to freedom, they said, the Russians said to him, go straight across the bridge, and he deliberately zigzagged. You're not my boss. As my kids sometimes say to us, sometimes said when they were younger. You're not my boss, right? That's what you say. And when you experience that, and when you sit at the Seder and you recognize that you are recreating that moment when the Israelites said to an outside world, "You're not controlling us, we're free." We have had that ability to do that, that creates an ability that we've had to again and again, unfortunately, put into use during our history. Okay, I'll talk about. Yeah, very good. Okay, the question is raised: isn't it really on Yud Nisan when they take the sheep? So the answer is, on some level, yes, it was a process, but it was only when they actually slaughtered that sheep. In other words, they took it, they said, we're going to do it. Now, we'll talk about that, because that'll bring us to Shabbos HaGadol, and I want to leave it at that'll be the last thing we talk about. But your point is well taken, that they took it 10 days before, four days before, as it says here. And the fact is that you are creating a situation right then and there, which is dangerous, but it's when you sacrifice, when you offer that sheep, and you eat it on the 15th at night, That creates the freedom. The second very, very important message that emerges from this moment is something else that emerges over and over again in the Jewish text, and that is the centrality of family as the most important unit in our survival. Let's understand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has announced that there's a new nation that's going to be born tomorrow. One would expect declarations of independence, rallies in town square, the way other nations are born. Committee meetings to create a constitution. Thank God we didn't have committee meetings. We'd still be in Egypt. But the fact is that that's not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us to do. What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say to do? Go home. Go home. Sit down and have a family meal. And when you sit down and you have that family meal, and you eat that meal together in the darkness of Egypt, what you are underscoring is that if the family is healthy, your community will be healthy. If the family is, I've often said that the greatest failing, and I can only talk about the part of the diaspora that I lived in, the greatest failing of American Jewry is not assimilation. Assimilation is a symptom, it's not the disease. The greatest failing of American Jewry was the abdication of the family unit's responsibility to educate the young. The thought that I can send my kids to an afternoon school, to this, or even among committed Jews, I could do this and not observe the laws and they can learn it. And no, it's the family unit that educates. When people would come to me in shul and say to me, you know, the school has to teach my children not to cheat, I would say, oh, the school has to teach your children not to cheat. You're supposed to teach your children not to cheat. And if you tell them when they go, when they're 12 years old, and or 13 years old, that they can go to the movie and say that they're 12 just to get it, you've taught them to cheat. In other words, how what we model for children and grandchildren has so much in it and is so critical to the education of those children. So therefore, going back to the family is an important component. If you look at the Korban Pesach, though, you see, even more than that, you see the societal structure. It says, begin with the family. And then it says, if the family can't do it, can't eat this, consume this, v'lokachu u'sheino akarova beito, then you reach out to the neighbor who is near to your house. Well, that sounds redundant, doesn't it? By definition, a neighbor is near to your house. What you're saying is neighbor now becomes part of your household. So if you as a family can't do all the things that need to be done, that's when community is created. But then it ends, ish lefi achlo tachosu alaseh, everybody has to do his or her bit. Don't say because there's family and community, I don't have to be the one to do it. I remember years ago coming to Israel and meeting a Chiloni Jew who said, you know, I have tremendous respect for those who are more observant. It's like I feel that they are the soldiers guarding the border, guarding Judaism. But because they're doing it, I don't have to do it. And I said, well, if every soldier said that in the Jewish army, then we'd really be in trouble. Every person has a responsibility. And that's what Moshe says when he turns to Paro and says, "Binorenu v'skenenu v'leich, b'vanenu v'vanenu." We're a people that's not limited to a select few. we're people that everyone has to do their part. So you see, built into the structure of the Korban Pesach is community building, family, society, individual responsibility, ritually built into the fabric of this very first, of one of these very first mitzvot. But now let's, given your question, let's do the segue to this Shabbos. This Shabbos is not one of the four Shabbatot, it's a fifth Shabbos that has its own specific name. It's Shabbos HaGadol, the Shabbos before Pesach. In this case, Pesach will be on Shabbat, so it's the Shabbat before it, a week before. Now, why is this Shabbat? First of all, what's interesting is that this Shabbat does not have a special Torah reading like the other four Shabbatot did. It only has a special Haftorah. And the question is, why is it called Shabbos HaGadol? What makes this HaGadol? So there are a number of interpretations. Some say HaGadol because this was the time when the rabbi would give a long speech. HaGadol. And in fact, interestingly enough, I've often said that our expectations of rabbis that they should deliver a sermon every Shabbos is an inhuman expectation. It's like delivering a thesis every Shabbos if you have an educated population. Used to be the rabbis only spoke at critical Shabbatot, Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos Shuvah. I think that would make a lot of people happier, but I'm not going to discuss that. Depends on your rabbi. But the fact is that one way or the other, it's Shabbos HaGadol because this was the Shabbat where the rabbi would give a long speech. Another possibility is it's Shabbat HaGadol because of the end of the Haftorah, which speaks about the Yom HaGadol V'Hanora, when Eliyahu will come, V'Heshiv Lev Avot Abanim, the great day of the time of Mashiach, of redemption. But there's another answer, and the other answer is that it is Shabbos, it's a great Shabbos because it recreates a miraculous moment. It recreates the moment when on the 10th day of Nisan, see, during the year of the Exodus, Exodus occurred on Thursday, which meant that the 10th day of Nisan was Shabbat. And it was on that day when we took this animal in the full view of the Egyptians, and that day could have led to pogroms. That day could have led to, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a miraculous protection, and we were able to do it. And we took that seh, and we, in full view, we tied it to the front of our homes, and we said, "Everybody, watch! Come a few days from now, we're going to shecht this animal, and we're gonna eat our Korban Pesach." And since that day was marked by that miraculous event, it's called Shabbos HaGadol. But there is a very important question about that approach. If we are recreating an event that took place on the 10th day of Nisan, then when should it be recreated each year? On the 10th day of Nisan, not on the Shabbat. Just because that year, Shabbat and the 10th day of Nisan correlated, we celebrate on Shabbat HaGadol. We don't do that with any other festival. Right? We don't say because the Yetzias Mitzrayim took place on a Thursday, therefore Pesach is always going to be on Thursday. It always goes by the calendar date, not the day of the week. Why then, if this is the reason for Shabbat HaGadol, why are we celebrating it on Shabbat? It occurred to me many years ago that perhaps the answer lies in what this day represented. What this day represented was a rejection of the gods of others and an acceptance of our God. What's Shabbat? By definition, we are rejecting what everybody else feels is important to be able to come closer to our God. We're rejecting the jobs that the world consider are important. We're rejecting the phone. We're rejecting all sorts of commerce. Everything that everybody out, that we even in our lives consider to be so critical and so important, and we're saying, you know what, it's not the most important thing in life. And therefore, that is the message of that 10th day of Nisan, since that message correlates to the message of Shabbat, perhaps that's why we mark it every year on Shabbat. And it gives us another insight into what we're doing on Shabbat, which is really rejecting that which everyone else considers important, and that which often we consider too important, and coming back home. All right. We'll stop there. Are there any questions, comments, anything that anyone wants to bring up? Tanur Shelechnai.
So that was the written Torah, right? No,
That's the oral Torah. That is the oral, that's in the Gemara. It's the oral Torah. It's the oral Torah, which was the application of written law, is part of the oral Torah. So they were making a decision. So it's oral, part of the oral law. Okay, we're going to stop there. Next week, just as a reminder, we're not going to have this shiur, but I understand that there is going to be a wonderful opportunity to hear two great rabbis who are brothers. Rabbi Yosef Adler and Rabbi Aharon Adler, from what I understand, are both going to be giving shiurim.
Adler,
right. Rabbi Aharon Adler is a rabbi here in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yosef Adler has just retired from Rinat Yisrael Synagogue in Teaneck, New Jersey, where he was Rav for many years. And they are brothers, and they're both wonderful speakers and wonderful teachers. So if you have the opportunity to come, I would highly recommend it. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful Chag Kosher V'Sameach, a wonderful Pesach. Thank you for listening and being here. And Bezras Hashem, we'll see you after the Chag.